It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a political scientist about a challenge to contraceptive coverage under the Affordable Care Act with a case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
First, issues like the long-running war in Syria and the developing crisis in Ukraine keep raising the question, what role should the United States play in international politics?
With the rise of regional powers around the world, places like China, Brazil, India, and Russia, there's been talk that American power and influence are on the decline, but our next guest doesn't buy that line of thinking. Bruce Jones is with us. He's senior fellow and director of the International Order and Strategy Project at Brookings. His new book is Still Ours to Lead, America, Rising Powers, and the Tension Between Rivalry and Resentment. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Bruce, to paraphrase Mark Twain, you say that reports of American decline have been greatly exaggerated. Why?
That's right. For two reasons. First, when you look at the fundamentals of American power, I think it becomes clear that we are not a power in decline. We're an enduring power on the international stage. And second, when you look at the rising actors, there's been a lot of discussion about the rise of the rest, China, India, Brazil, Russia, etc. What you see is that storyline has been somewhat exaggerated, and that these are powers very deeply divided amongst themselves. The United States does not confront a block of rising powers. It confronts lots of complicated issues, but the United States is an enduring power and still, and for some time to come, by far and away the most influential actor on the world stage.
In your book, you're worried about two foreign policy extremes, a step back from involvement in the world, almost an isolationist approach on the one hand, or take an aggressive, dominant stance with a lot of military intervention. What are you looking for?
I think the United States has to have the confidence of its own position. We have an extraordinary number of assets at our disposal and an astonishing number of allies. And what you see in an acute crisis like the Ukraine, all eyes are on Washington to see how we can lead. There's a risk of overextending ourselves. There's a risk when we resort too quickly to the military tool. We have a whole host of other tools that we can use to galvanize collective action, to isolate countries, to put pressure on countries. The military option has to be there. The military power that we have is an essential component of our leadership. But we have this much broader range of tools, and when we can build strong coalitions with our allies and with some of these new actors with whom we have overlapping interests, we're in a much stronger position.
Well, I mentioned some of the rising regional powers. You did too. There are the BRIC nations. That stands for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Rising powers that could eclipse American influence, at least in their regions. But you say Russia maybe shouldn't be on that list. Why not?
Well, one of the points I make in the book is that there's no mortar in the bricks. These are very divided powers. But I do think that Russia is a different phenomenon. Russia has recovered since the total collapse of its economy at the end of the Soviet period. So it, from that incredible nadir, it has been rising. But Russia is a deeply dysfunctional country. Its economy is in a shambles. It's in a very weak geopolitical position, and I think we shouldn't overestimate it. The others are actually rising. They are rising economically, and they are rising in their influence. There's a second point. With China, with India, and Brazil, they've buttered their bread on the side of globalization and a stable global system. So although we have tensions with them in their region, security tensions, there's a lot where we have shared interests or overlapping interests. I think it looks very different with Russia.
With Brazil, India, and China in particular, to what extent are they rivals economically, geostrategically, and to what extent are they potential partners?
Yeah, they're both, and I think that's the most important dynamic in the international system right now. All of these are actors who have been in a subsidiary position in the international system. They're frustrated by that. They've grown economically, and they want to exert their influence on the world stage. At the same time, at core, they recognize that they do rely on a stable international system for energy flows, for financial flows, for trade flows, and they can't produce that stability by themselves. They have no real choice but to cooperate with the United States in some places. So in their own regions, they may try to rival us. Globally, they have to cooperate with us, and we have to find a way to live with that duality.
Does the rest of the world want the United States to play a leadership role, or will resentment against us increase when we try to step into that role?
There's nothing worse than American leadership other than all the other options. Every time that it looks like we may step away from a leadership role, people confront the reality that there are no other options, and that the consequence of America stepping away from a leadership function is a void, and more conflict. So people are often frustrated or resentful of American leadership, but when they're actually confronted by the alternatives, they recognize that American leadership is better than those alternatives.
And domestically, do Americans want the country to play a leadership role? There are concerns about costs, getting entangled in foreign conflicts, economic costs, and if the military option is there, cost in human life.
Yes, that's right. And I think what we see, is a sort of divide in the polls where Americans recognize, probably as much as at any point in history, that the United States has no choice but to be engaged in the world. Our economy depends on it. 30% of our economy now depends on foreign trade. There's just no choice but to be engaged in the world. People are gun-shy, though. They don't want us to get ourselves involved in complicated, long, drawn-out wars and repeats of Iraq. And I think the administration and the foreign policy community is going to have to do a better job of explaining why it is that American power helps reduce conflict in a number of ways and prevent aggression in a number of places in a way that's very different than the kind of long entanglements we got ourselves into in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Looking at the last couple of administrations, the second Bush administration, the Obama administration, do you get the sense that there have been guiding doctrines in how we deal with this leadership role, or are we just making it up as we go?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think the Bush administration, for a brief period of time, was a little bit seduced by the scale of American power. They had power at a moment where really the potential rivals out there were extremely weak. There was nothing to constrain American power, and there were some excesses in that mode. I think the Obama administration, by contrast, has been a little too leery, has overlearned some of the lessons of Afghanistan, too much of a sense of any time you step into a conflict, you're going to be sucked into a long quagmire, and that's not always true. Although, to give them credit, I think they played a very different kind of role, for example, in Libya. So every administration struggles with this, and the world has been changing rapidly, and we're beginning to see the administration come to terms with the fact that there is no real alternative still but to American leadership.
But speaking in the abstract so far, let's look at some concrete real-world examples. Ukraine, Russia, Crimea, all over the news lately. What do you think of what you've been seeing in the United States' response to that?
It was interesting watching this. I mean, in the first couple of days, people were awfully critical of the president in terms of the scale and the tenor of the response. But I think even within within a few more days, we've seen that the announcement of the second wave of sanctions, the reinforcing of NATO assets in Eastern Europe, and very importantly, kind of getting on the same page with Europe and working really hard to kind of push the Europeans to be in a more assertive position. There was a lot of wooliness to the early European response. So I think we've seen a pretty clear response from the administration so far. It's not going to reverse Russia's actions in the Crimea, but I think the real test is, does it stop Putin from taking the next step in terms of military intervention deeper into the Ukraine? And we'll have to see in the coming days.
Was there a void in American leadership, though, leading up to this situation, not recognizing what we had to deal with in Putin, maybe being too aggressive to expand NATO eastward, making trade ties with Ukraine that might have ticked Russia off? What did you think of the leadership in the years leading up to this current crisis?
You know, I think one of the challenges that American foreign policy confronts is that we're going to have to come to grips with the reality that there is no alternative to American leadership in Europe, in the Middle East, and in Asia, all at the same time, as well as on major global issues. And we've been in a mode where we can kind of pivot to Asia, we get sucked back into the Middle East, we neglect Europe, and that's just not going to work. And I do think it's the case that as events in Ukraine were unfolding, a lot of our attention was in the Middle East, some of our attention was Asia, and not a lot of our attention was in Europe. And this has reminded us that the European allies are still core to our place in the world. And the United States is going to have to come to terms with that need to be engaged simultaneously in multiple theaters.
Looking at a situation like Syria or Libya that you mentioned earlier, there's a choice sometimes between trying to build a grand coalition, maybe via the UN, but if we're blocked there, maybe with NATO, we're blocked there, we go it alone. How do we navigate that? How do we juggle that?
Yeah, I think the principle is the widest coalition that's possible, right? And so if you can get an extraordinarily broad coalition like we had in support of action in Libya, that's worth getting. And when you have core interests and the coalition isn't there, you're going to have to act. But the real challenge is to recognize that the wider the coalition, the better. and that that doesn't come about just in the moment of the crisis. You have to do a lot of work in advance of a crisis to build the kinds of relationships that matter when you need them in a crisis. And I don't think yet that we're seeing that with respect to countries like India and Brazil and South Africa and Indonesia, all these sort of second-tier emerging powers who are actually very important to the response. We see, for example, in Ukraine, how much Russia has tried to look to India and to China to bolster his argument. They haven't really bolstered it, but I don't think that we've done enough to build our relationship with those countries to broaden the scope of friends that we have in the system.
We're talking about the role of the United States in international affairs, international events, with Bruce Jones. His new book is Still Ours to Lead.
We continue our conversation now with Bruce Jones. He's the author of Still Ours to Lead, and he makes the case that the United States is not in decline on the world stage and that the U.S. should still take an active leadership role.
You can join in the conversation. What role would you like to see the United States play in world politics in general? Should it take a leadership role, or in places like Ukraine and Syria in particular? When should the United States stay out of things? When should we get involved diplomatically, economically, militarily? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Bruce, it seems like you're calling us to juggle a lot of things, and sometimes it seems like at least we in the media, and I think our government too, kind of focus on the crisis of the moment, the headline of the moment. How can we keep our attention on all those, keep all those balls in the air at the same time?
It's going to be a real challenge. I don't spend a lot of time on this in the book, but I've made the case in other places that the United States is going to have to recognize that it needs high-level diplomatic engagement in all of these regions simultaneously. I'm not convinced that we have the right structure for that. Having a Secretary of State who has to fly back and forth across the Atlantic to the Middle East, flit out to Asia, I'm not sure that that's going to be enough. I think we may need to get innovative about how we structure our diplomatic presence around the world to sustain that high-level political engagement.
Interesting. How do we do that?
We'll have to get creative. I'd be interested in exploring ideas like creating a new position for a deputy secretary of state in Asia based in the region, things like that. I think we have to recognize that these are all regions that are going to want to see high-level political engagement, and it's not enough to have an ambassador or an undersecretary of state following up on these issues sometimes.
Are we a domestically focused nation? Do we not take the rest of the world seriously enough until there's a crisis on our doorstep?
It's very interesting if you look at the polling. I think that's changing a lot. The younger you get in the polling, the more you find people are engaged in the world and interested in the world. I think that's just part of the changing demographics of the country. It's also true when you look at different cities that a lot of the fastest growing cities in the United States now are plugged into global trade. So I think it's changing. I think that people are well aware of what's going on in the world and plugged into the world. There's still this deep debate, of course, about how much of our blood and treasure we should expend and try to lead.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jeff on the line in Green Bay. Jeff, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. No matter what you want, right now the United States does not have a leader that is equipped to handle or lead on the international stage. If you look at the latest gesture with the Soviet Republic and Crimea, the sanctions that he threw out were so utterly pointless. Putin just blew him off and said, I don't care. So right now, no matter what we want, we just don't have a leader that is equipped to lead.
Jeff, thanks for the call. So President Obama doesn't have the stature, the skill to lead in the ways you're looking for, Bruce.
Yeah, I don't agree. Certainly not on the sanctions. The first round of sanctions that he announced were pretty feckless, but within about 3 days, it announced the second round of sanctions, which are much tougher than anything we've seen out of any U.S. administration for 20 years in terms of the dealing with Russia. And he's authorized, he's given himself the authority for a much deeper round of sectoral sanctions, which, if enacted, would really bring the Russian economy to its knees. And there are some risks in that. So I think he's wise to take this in a graduated way. You don't want to rush to a huge trade war with Russia. There are real stakes here. People forget that as we speak, Russia is allowing NATO to overfly its territory and helping us refuel our bases in Afghanistan to deal with the war on terrorism in Afghanistan. So there's a lot at stake here just beyond Crimea. So a kind of graduated response actually makes sense to me. And I think the second round of sanctions have been pretty tough.
You know, that's a theme I see again and again, issues with countries like Iran over their nuclear program, but occasionally cooperation of them on issues related to terrorism. How tough is that to balance? On one hand, we're rivals. We have this core conflict. On the other hand, we have this room for cooperation.
Right, and it's a key theme in my book, hence the subtitle of the tension between rivalry and restraint, because there are places where we have overlapping and shared interests. Defeating Al-Qaeda is one, combating terrorism is one, the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, the Brazilians, they all share a sense of the threat that terrorism poses, and they're willing to cooperate with us in pretty extensive ways on trade protection, on counter-piracy, on economic issues. There are a whole host of places where we want to cooperate with these states. And at the same time, they're going to challenge us and be rivals to us in a certain set of security issues. Now, I think with Russia, Russia's own actions will have tipped the balance here such that, you know, the rivalry is now going to outpace the cooperation. Still, there are things that they do that are very useful to us.
Go back to our callers now with Bernie in Elkhorn. Bernie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to say that if you look objectively at U.S. history from at least World War II into the present, there are many historians and reporters, Noam Chomsky, et cetera, who could tell you that the United States has been and is an empire. We've got the military in over 130 countries. We have overthrown democratically elected governments in places like Iran, Chile, et cetera. We have illegally invaded and occupied numerous countries. We have drones killing thousands of people illegally in many countries. To say that we have a moral high ground is completely ridiculous. And the only leadership we have is a mafia-type leadership where our military is going to get what it wants in the interest of our corporate interests. And the only other thing that we do is try to do whatever Israel wants. We support hideous regimes like Egypt, Bahrain, Israel, Saudi Arabia. And in the Ukraine, there was a coup. The government there was ousted by force.
Bernie, thanks for the call. So the United States has not only used but abused its leadership position around the world in the last 60 years or so, Bruce.
Yeah, there's no question that we have at times. I don't use the phrase moral high ground in the book. The case I make is that when you look at states' interests, and I think that it's very important to bring it down to interests, we simply see an underlying reality that the power we have is not checked by any of these other actors. And there's this very interesting phenomenon that for China, for India, for Brazil, less so for Russia, they look at American power, they see some of the constraints it imposes on them. They see some of the downsides. They see some of the times when we've used our power in aggressive ways. But they also see that if American power retreated from their region, they'd be faced with a vacuum and with conflict, and that there are a whole host of other things that the United States does. You know, it's the U.S. Navy that maintains the security of the flow of oil out of the Gulf, out of the Straits of Hormuz. Every major economy in the world is dependent on that, none more than China and India. So they're in a sort of funny position where, on the one hand, they're a little bit sympathetic to the last caller. They see some of the strains that come out when the United States uses its power in unilateral ways or uses its power aggressively. On the other hand, they recognize that there are whole critical functions of the global economy and stable flow of energy, stability in key regions that are really dependent on American power, and that it's in their interest that things continue that way, at least to some degree.
Thanks for the call, Bernie. Now we have Sundar on the line in Milwaukee. Sundar, hi.
Hello. How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I just wanted to make a comment. Having lived in India the first 20 years of my life and in the States the last 20 years, I think American leadership is still very, very important globally. I think we're just at a stage where we're trying to find a balance in that leadership, especially the post-George Bush era. And I think what Obama is trying to do is find a semblance of balance to basically address Asia, the Middle East, and Europe. And as time evolves, I think we will find the balance. I do remember my dad, who was pretty much a moderate. He was very thrilled when George Bush decided to, you know, to take on Al-Qaeda, basically, in Afghanistan.
Sundar, I want to jump in and give Bruce Jones a chance to respond. Are you optimistic, Bruce, that we're going to find the balance you've written about that Sundar was talking about?
I'm an inveterate optimist, so I tend to agree. Yeah, look, I do think that it's well put. This notion of balance, and it's of two types. I use the phrase in the book that the United States needs to lead, not dominate. There have been times when we've conflated the concept of leadership with the aggressive use of unilateral military power. There are going to be times and places where we have no choice but to pursue military action unilaterally, but it should be the last resort, and we should exhaust all of our other options before we do that, and that got out of balance. And so this notion of balance between coalition building on the one hand and military power on the other is very important, as is this notion of balance between the dynamics of rivalry and the restraint that's potentially there if we focus on it and build up our patterns of cooperation where we have shared interests.
We'll leave it there. Bruce, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Bruce Jones. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the International Order and Strategy Project at Brookings. His new book is Still Ours to Lead.